Good morning. It's good to be with you this morning. I'll open us with prayer. God be with you. O God, who created all peoples in your image, we thank you for the wonderful diversity of races and cultures in this world. Enrich our lives by ever-widening circles of fellowship, and show us your presence in those who differ most from us, until our knowledge of your love is made perfect in our love for all your children. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Thank you, Adeline. And thanks to those of you who've joined us here in the nave today and online for our authors forum to kick off what we're calling the Becoming Beloved Community Book Corner, which is now in St. Columbus Commons. The Book Corner, or we call it the BBCBC for short, is a project by Stirring the Waters and the Anti-Racism Task Force. And we have Lauren Counts here, who is the chair of Stirring the Waters and also has been involved with the Anti-Racism Task Force since its inception several years ago, just to say a few words about those ministries here.
Thank you, Sandra, and thank you to our panelists today. Really looking forward to this, and welcome to all of you. I just want to say a couple words. I am Lauren Counts. I lead the Stirring the Waters ministry, which was created several years ago and is dedicated to racial justice. We meet monthly to learn and pray together and reflect on our personal journeys. Our ministry runs the Sacred Ground learning series, which takes place over several months, and there are sessions ongoing right now. We also are active in the refugee ministry, in history, the History Project, which Sandra has led, and there are copies in the back if you want to read further, as well as our housing advocacy. So we welcome new members and welcome engagement in the education work we are doing, as well as I'm involved in the Anti-Racism Task Force, and there are several members here today, as well as Stirring the Waters, and that is the ministry which is dedicated to the journey that the church is on in becoming an anti-racist church. So many thanks to all of you involved in those many efforts. And I'll turn it back to Sandra. Thank you.
Thanks, Lauren. How many people here have participated in Stirring the Waters or the Anti-Racism Task Force? Okay. How about in book groups on reparations? Okay. And somebody here gone on the Alabama trip? Okay. And attended a Washington Interfaith Network event? Okay. How about taking a Sacred Ground course? All right. So, it looks like we're kind of preaching to the choir here. So I think it probably goes without saying that these are not ordinary times. Just in the last 2 months, we've received executive orders that have eliminated from the federal government websites with guidance materials on diversity, equity, and inclusion, fired the people who were responsible for those programs, and threatened funding cuts to schools and universities whose programs are deemed to contain DEI in their curricula. Orders have called for the elimination of the small agency, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, the federal agency that was created by Congress to improve and support the nation's public libraries and museums. And an order has even called for an end to funding of the African American Museum, as well as other Smithsonian museums, honoring the rich history of this nation on the grounds that they somehow promote racial ideology. And when our own Bishop Marianne Buddy gently called on the president to show mercy to vulnerable groups, he responded by denouncing the so-called bishop as radical left, nasty in tone, and demanded an apology from her and her church, which I guess includes us. So we haven't apologized, have we? And the good news is that a commitment to mercy and racial justice and truth about our history is alive and well here at St. Columba's. So we decided to move some of the books on these topics up from our library on the second floor to this nook here in the Commons. And then we've added a lot of books to that collection to make these resources readily available to parishioners who may not venture down to the second floor very often. Many of the donated books have come from personal collections of parishioners at St. Columba's. A shout out especially to the Vaden family, who gave us a lot of books, and then Ray Suarez, who moved half of his library out. I think his wife was very grateful to have some extra shelf space at the house. And let me say, unfortunately, Ray has been stuck in San Francisco this week and emailed me and said he will not be able to make it here today. But he sends his regrets, and I recommend many of his books. They are on the shelves in the book corner. And if you haven't read them already, I recommend that you take a look at his History of Latino Americans, his recent book on the immigrant experience, We Are Here, a book on the politics of faith in America, and another one on the displacement of black and brown communities. And as we were reviewing this rich body of literature, we really were delighted to find that it included books written by Episcopalians here in our midst, and we wanted to sort of highlight some of those. So, one more thing. There's one other author who is not present here. His name is Emmanuel Lemoyne. He was a rector here at St. Columba's during the 1930s when Jim Crow was firmly in place here in Washington, D.C. and around the country, and even to some extent at St. Columba's. They're out of print, but his grandson loaned us copies, and so we just made photocopies of these two books, and they touch on racial issues during that period. And, his children all went to seminary. One of them became very involved in the civil rights movement during Lemoyne's lifetime, and no doubt with his encouragement. So I commend those to you as well. They're sort of stuck back in a corner on the shelves, so I wanted to bring them all to your attention. We have three Episcopalian authors here to talk about their books, which are so well done and inspiring. So let me introduce first Clara, or Tiggy Green, as she is known, a longtime member of St. Columba's. Janice Evans, who is a longtime parishioner at St. George's in Bloomingdale, and another St. Columban author, Stuart Chapman. And so, Tiggy, let me start with you. Your book, which is between, why don't you hold it up there so everybody can see it, yeah. Between Freedom and Equality. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in writing this book.
My co-author is Barbara Torrey, and she and I wrote a history of our neighborhood called Brookmont, a neighborhood on the Potomac. And we realized that we needed to, after we wrote the book, we really needed to learn more about the area along the Potomac River, which is about a mile within the border with D.C. And so we started researching the original canals that went around Little Falls and Great Falls. And each of those canals is known as Potomac Canal. And of course, that preceded the C&O Canal that is we know now. And we learned about a man named George Poynter, who was born enslaved and who worked for his whole life on these canals. And this information is the basis of our book. The local canals, shall I just go ahead?
Yeah, keep going, sure.
You can wave at me if I'm going on too long. The local canals.
Hold the mic a little closer. Hold the
I'm
mic.
Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Like that. Yeah, right there.
Okay.
You're a cabaret singer here.
The local canals were developed by the Potomac Company, which was founded by George Washington in 1785. And he wanted to facilitate commerce, particularly to Georgetown, and of course, tobacco. And the first person to work on these canals around the falls was a child, an enslaved child, named George Poynter. And his owner rented him out at age 13 to Washington's company. And we learned that there was a letter written by Poynter in 1829 that existed in the National Archives in the Canal Company's records. And so the letter was, he asks in the letter, he writes to the C&O Canal Company, had just been formed, to spare his cottage because his cottage where he lived was in the path of the canal that they were building around Little Falls. And in the letter, Poynter describes in some detail his life and his life's work. And we saw all of this collaborated. Am I doing okay here?
You're doing great, thanks.
Sorry. Poynter was born in 1773 on a tobacco plantation in rural Maryland. And when he was rented out at age 13 to the Potomac Company, they gave him a place to live along the river and gave him a small salary, which they allowed him to keep. And by age 19, he'd saved enough money to buy his own freedom from his owner, who was a man named Wallace. And he spent the rest of his life working for this Potomac Company on the canals. He started as a laborer and ended up as what was called a supervisory engineer. His name appears occasionally in the company records between 1796 and 1829, and he died sometime in the early 30s. We don't know his death date. During his work at the Potomac Company, he met George Washington, who would drop by to inspect the work on the canals in the falls, and Washington would give a dollar to each squadron of men working there. Poynter himself was always referred to as Captain Poynter, perhaps because he owned his own boat. He was clearly respected at any rate. In 1828, at the inaugural groundbreaking of the C&O Canal, President John Quincy Adams presided over the ceremony near what is now, the ceremony took place at what is now Lock 6 of that canal. And George Poynter was put in charge of organizing the boats that would transport guests to the ceremony. And he piloted the barge carrying the president, John Quincy Adams, and helping steer the barge was his granddaughter, Mary Ann, who was eight years old, and she never forgot that she did that and that she also got to dance with the president at the festivities. And she would eventually marry, and in the 1850s, she and her husband bought a two-acre farm called Dry Meadows in what is now Chevy Chase, D.C. Only 9% of free black people in D.C. at that time owned property, and before her death, she divided the property among her four children, and Poynter descendants owned the property, 2 acres, until 1828, when the government, using eminent domain, forced its sale so that they could construct Lafayette Elementary School. We discovered that several Poynter descendants in D.C. were among numerous people that lost their homes as a result of, black people who lost their homes as a result of development and the use of eminent domain. And they were, of course, building schools at the time for white children.
Tiggy, let me just ask you.
Yes.
So the Poynter descendants, you've connected with them, right? You've
yes.
gotten to know them, right?
Yes.
Tell us how that happened. How did you get to know The living descendants.
Well, we wanted very much to find them, and so we went to Ancestry and found, we had meanwhile gone down and the Pointers had three children, and then there were granddaughter and then great-grand. And so through those names, we were able to find names like that on Ancestry, and we connected to a man named James Fisher, and these were his descendants. He knew nothing about his ancestor, George Pointer, nothing. Mm-hmm. He was wondering about these two white women contacting him and saying, we know about your ancestor. He was fascinated and inspired by the story and the story of Pointer's work. And he and his partner, Tanya, this is what I was going to tell you at the end, but that's fine. She had helped him find his ancestry, Tanya did. And so they organized a family reunion held at Lafayette Park, near the Lafayette School, elementary school, not the big Lafayette Park at the near the White House, but and it was the property. So there, all these people were able, descendants were able to get together on property that had once belonged to their ancestor.
And the park has since been renamed, right?
Yes. They were very responsible for getting the name of the park changed to Lafayette Pointer Park. Now, yeah. Pointer Pointer never lived there, but it was his granddaughter, who was named Mary Ann Harris, who did live there. And so that was, sadly, James died just about a little over a year ago. But he got to see the publication of the book. He wrote an introduction to the book, and he saw the changes with the name of the changes to the name of the park. And
yeah. So I've been over there, and if you haven't been to Lafayette Pointer Park, which is right just as you look at the Lafayette Elementary School, it's just off to the side, and it's been very nicely developed. And there is a big sign there that includes photos and part of the text of Tiggy and Barbara's book and what they found out about the Pointer family. So go over there and take a look.
Right. Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, there are a few more things, but if you have any questions.
I think what we'll do is we're going to, for the moment, move on to Janice Evans. And Janice, as I mentioned, is a longtime member of St. George's, located in the Bloomingdale neighborhood. And I think you knew Rose Duncan, right, there?
Yes.
Rose grew up at St. George's in Bloomingdale. And was, as we all know, was an assistant rector here at St. Columba's. When did you start worshiping at St. George's, Janice?
When did I start at St. George's?
Yeah.
I came to D.C. in 1982 mm-hmm. to attend Howard University Graduate School. Mm-hmm. And I found St. George's right in the neighborhood, literally a block from where I lived, and I've been there ever since.
Okay. And so you attended Howard, and you're a practicing psychotherapist, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. I have my own solo private practice. I provide counseling, individual and couples counseling, on all areas, mainly mm-hmm. anxiety, depression, communication issues, grief and loss, and unresolved childhood trauma. Mm-hmm.
And you have had kind of a specialty in healing racial trauma, is that right?
Not a specialty in terms of being trained in it, mm-hmm. but when I started writing this book and pulling from my experience, I think that that's something that I can relate to and relate to clients who come to me who are having racial trauma.
Right.
And so it's kind of become an area of interest after writing this book.
Why don't you show up, just so people can kind of get a sense of your book. And then you've also written a separate book
yes.
based on that called Poetically Black, Reflections on Racial on African-American joy, sorrow, and healing.
Yes.
So you took some of the stories and you made them into poetry.
Yes.
Okay.
This book shares my experiences from childhood all the way to adulthood, experiences that I've had with microaggressions, macroaggressions, you know, being treated a certain way because of the way I look, because of my skin color. So what triggered me to write these experiences down is the death of George Floyd. Seeing that on television just was devastating, to see this man killed in real time and we're watching, and that it was on video. So days after that, I started thinking about things that I've experienced, obviously not as severe, but just things that I put away, probably suppressed, not thought about for years, and I started writing down all of these experiences, and they kept piling up. For example, being told in college by a professor that I was never gonna be anything. Because I was not good in his political science class. I guess that's not my thing. The first time as 8 or 9 years old, being told by a white boy, a Canadian boy, that my skin was dirty. And I thought, because we were out in the park playing, I thought I had dirt on my face. So it took me minutes to figure out, when I saw this smirk on his face, what he was saying. So those are some experiences. That was from childhood. There are several more from adulthood. So I started writing them down. And after a while, I said, I wonder if this could be a book. My father always told me, write a book. So I just started putting them together, and I showed them to a couple of my friends who are into literature and African-American history. And then I located a publishing consultant. And she told me, yes, but add more about how you healed. So the last chapter of the book talks about how you identify how it has affected your self-esteem and your identity, and what can you do to rewrite the narrative in terms of how it affected you. How can you look at the positive influences you've had over time in your life that can help heal that? And one of those healers was growing up in a home that made faith very important, growing up in an Episcopal church, and just being validated, you know, for who you are. And then even when I moved down here in 1982, being able to find St. George's and being involved in ministry and being validated, you know, for making a difference and helping people. That rewrites the narrative and heals the wounds of the negative messages you got about, you received about who you are. So that's how this book came about. The poetry book was written 2 years later, and the poetry book is an extension of recollections about race, because what I've done is just put these stories in poetry form. So it shares the experiences of African Americans growing up in America and the things that are on their minds. It's very internal, things that we don't talk about. But when you put them to poetry, I think it makes it more palatable for people to read and accept and understand, mm-hmm. and gain empathy about the experiences of growing up Black in America, right. and growing up as a Black woman in America.
Yeah, and Tiggy, I seem to recall watching an interview back when James Fisher was alive about the trauma that he had experienced, because his family was so broken apart as a result of these multiple displacements from their neighborhoods. And so that, Janice, it doesn't sound like that was really part of your trauma, or was it? Did your family experience displacement from their home?
No.
Okay.
We were blessed and to grow up in a great family, great neighborhood, great neighbors, and being a part of the church. Mm-hmm. That was part of our community. Right. So, grew up in the same house until we were 8 years old, and until I was 8 years old, we moved to another neighborhood, mm-hmm. which was predominantly white at the time, with a few black families, but over the years, the white families did move out. Mm-hmm. So I did see that. Mm-hmm. But it, in terms of it being a traumatic displacement, no.
Right, okay. Well, I'm wondering if you would feel comfortable reading a couple of your poems. There's one in here, I think this is page 7. The elevator door closed. Yeah. I mean, this is something I think we've all kind of had an experience with.
Oh, right. The elevator door closed. I entered the car while they stayed behind. I waited, holding the door, like a Pullman porter for the family of three. They looked away, and the elevator door closed. I wondered as the car ascended. Did my smile turn them off? Or was it my puffy purple parka and fuzzy red cowl? Or my black coarse hair and dark brown skin, making friendly eye contact impossible? The car ascended, rising above pettiness, passing all floors of bigotry and fear, leaving a racist act of ignorance on the lower level, where it belongs.
Thank you. And there are many other wonderful poems in here. I'd like to have her read more of them, but I want to move on, so maybe we'll have a little time for question and answers. And now we turn to Stuart Chapman. And you haven't been here since birth, have you, Stuart? No.
Around 17 or 18, we moved from Capitol Hill to this neighborhood.
Okay.
We moved earlier, but we had been stuck in the throes of the Catholic Church down the street until we were liberated and came to the Episcopalians.
Yay. There are many disaffected Roman Catholics here. So Stuart has written a book, fascinating, a biography of Shelby Foote. And it's been 35 years, it's hard to believe, since Ken Burns' documentary on the Civil War was first aired. It's still around. In fact, there was something on PBS last night about it. And Shelby Foote, if you recall, was a Southern gentleman smoking a pipe, sitting in an armchair, narrating a lot of the story of the Civil War. And you had the impression watching him that he'd actually lived through it. It was just totally gripping and absorbing to all of us, Southerners and Northerners, Yankees and whatever alike. Stuart, I wonder if you could tell us how you came about to write this biography.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I too had seen the series, and it is frequently aired. There was also a mention of Shelby Foote on a recent Saturday Night Live monologue, which is sort of crazy and not on the usual channels. But Shelby Foote appears in that series, I believe it's 86 or 87 times, don't quote me on that, versus the next most was around 16, I believe. I was working a PhD at Boston University under a Faulkner scholar there, and this was...
Let me interrupt you. You're from the South, am I correct?
I am from Alabama, all over Alabama. My dad, not Arkansas, but my dad is I'm the son of a Methodist minister, so we moved a lot.
Okay. So you're at Boston University, and you're looking for a dissertation topic. Is that right?
Well, yes, and I was working on a dissertation topic that was Southern cartography in the cartography in the 1930s Southern lit. There are a number of maps that appear, and I had my one epiphany in my life where I was going to work on a political campaign, and I ended up calling my doctoral dissertation professor, and I said, hey, I've been working on the Shelby Foote biography on the side. I'm going to use it and get the heck out of here. So that was the basis of it. It was a basis of a doctoral dissertation, but was published by a university press in Mississippi.
Well, I really found it fascinating, and I will say, he won't tell you this, but it won the Eudora Welty Prize for scholarship about the South, I think, is what the prize is given for. And Foote actually, he was an author, right? He actually wrote the trilogy about the history of the Civil War. And, you know, your book takes us back to how the Confederate cause has remained alive in the South. I mean, Foote was actually a pretty complicated guy. Your book opens up with this scene of him attending an event I have to find my notes to make sure I get this right here. It's a scene at the Forest Park, F-O-R-R-E-S-T, Park in Memphis, Tennessee, in which Foote expressed respect. This is late in his life. Foote is expressing respect for Nathan Bedford Forrest, an infamous enslaver and founder of the Ku Klux Klan. So how did Foote manage to come to that point of view about Forrest?
Foote was a very complicated individual, and he grew up around a lot of the plantation owners. If you think, he was very good friends with a guy named Walker Percy, if you know Walker Percy. And Walker Percy's family was from very esteemed plantation. They owned multiple plantations. Foote's family himself, although they had lost the money, his grandfathers had been of that class. By the time Foote's father dies early, was a salesman, and he grew up sort of as a ne'er-do-well, and was, what is interesting to me is the sort of arc of his life. He goes to the University of North Carolina in the 30s, is actually because of his maternal grandfather, who was Jewish, a Viennese Jew. There were anti-Semitic efforts against him at UNC. He left, went back, was much more progressive politically than, say, Walker Percy. And then, what is interesting, I would call him a sort of New Deal Democrat. And then as we get deeper into the 50s and 60s, when a lot of those segregationist governors come to power in the South, whether it's George Wallace in Alabama or Barnett in Mississippi, is that for him, the way to deal with the anxiety that he had was simply by writing about the Civil War. Largely largely depoliticized. Lots of sort of great figures, the Jefferson Davis of the world, the Abraham Lincolns. It doesn't completely elide over like incidents at Fort Pillow in Tennessee, but that was Shelby's way of sort of dealing with it. Sandra, I'm going to get to your question in a second. Yeah. And then Walker Percy, a pivotal moment, around the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the 60s, is that after Bloody Sunday, Walker Percy, who was coming full circle from where he had started his life, said to Shelby Foote, hey, let's go and be part of, there was a second march, 7 days after, of course. And Shelby Foote said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he, this arc of really engaging, really being sympathetic to the dynamics of the South, really being sort of plantocrat class. And then by the end of his life, this is actually after the Ken Burns series. He is in a park in Memphis, and on the grounds of Nathan Bedford Forrest was a brilliant military tactician. And that was sort of where he ended up in life, is that it was, the war for him provided personally a sort of refuge from a lot of these political anxieties that he had. And even to the point where he was in the middle of this park against hundreds of protesters defending forests.
Well, but he was at times critical of Southern white supremacists.
Certainly could be.
So what gives?
I think there's a famous book by a guy named Daniel Singal called The War Within. And as, you know, individuals, cultural leaders in the South were coming into the forefront, some of them actually went backwards. And I think there was always this tension in Foote's life, you know, both wanting to be sort of a class that he didn't have, while also being very, you know, he and Faulkner were friends. I mean, Faulkner certainly, for the most part, explodes a lot of those myths about race and class. But, you know, there are moments where you see him fall back on Foote, on the heritage of the people who fought for the South, you know, even in this Saturday Night Live monologue that was a couple of weeks ago by Shane Gillis, you know, of course he talks about this basically unreconstructed Foote who is cheering on. You can see him in the Ken Burns series per this monologue, cheering the South to win, you know, at all costs. And you can certainly see that kind of strain. So what is interesting to me, and is interesting in my life, seeing my parents, you know, is going through the 60s or reviewing what they did, is like, why didn't they do more? Or why wasn't there more to be done? Mm-hmm. So on racial issues. And so that's what's of interest to me.
Well, in your book, I this quote sort of stood out to me. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about Foote's Civil War trilogy, you said, it may be read to some extent as a displacement of the painful racial and political issues affecting him during the 50s and the 1960s. So do you think this avoidance of the painful truth about racism is still with us today? That's not a trick question.
No, without question, without question.
So, I mean, we hear this complaint about racial ideology, but nobody is really saying that the truth isn't the truth. They just don't want to hear about it. They don't want their children to feel bad about it. So I think I'm going to stop talking and let people have an opportunity to ask some questions. I hope that the truth is still with us here. Some of the books on the shelves in our book corner have been removed from shelves in public schools and public libraries today. So take advantage, and let's see if there are any questions.
Don't be shy. Thank you so much for this forum, and thank you so much for creating a place where we have more prominently displayed a variety of books. And I just a question about, say a little bit more about the book collection here and how we can all contribute. I recently just stumbled on, unintentionally, finding that listening to memoirs is a way of people who have a lot of courage and compassion has been a way of dealing with this time. And I've just am listening now to Ketanji Brown's and before that Sonia Sotomayor. And both of them, it's very interesting how very extensive in their narratives about their life is also very much they weave in a narrative about our racial identity and how that has shaped them. And that's been revelatory for me. And I just want to thank the work of Sacred Ground, because I think it has, over these past few years, we keep on learning, and there's more and more. So thank you very, very much for helping us.
There, okay, we're back. So there are books, the Ta-Nehisi Coates books, for example, are in the book corner. There's Howard Thurman, who was a spiritual advisor, really, to Martin Luther King Jr. Their books are there. There are books about the Ku Klux Klan. You know, I was sort of stunned when I learned recently that only about a third of the high school students in Montgomery County know what the Ku Klux Klan is. Yeah. And it's not a part of history. It's here with us today. So, all right, we have another question.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just looked up your books in the Arlington Public Library just to see what's available. And unfortunately, Janice, yours are not there yet. So I would like to put in a request at the public libraries for all the books. I'm also a public school teacher, and that is something we can do. I think all of us, for in, you know, Maryland, DC, we can request the books be put into the libraries. So just an action item for all of us. And if you have any suggestions on how we purchase your books too, like through which publishers, would love to know about that.
Great, thank you. Thank you for that. Joshua, you have something.
Yeah, just thinking about the your experience looking at the different histories and how language has been progressive and regressive, and the current administration very explicit, intentional acts of pulling words out of public use, politicizing words that have forever not been political, and what your experience in seeing that with DC is, and even with the South, about how are the publicly available language that we can use without feeling like we have become political or signaling our political affiliations, and how that affects our ability to speak publicly about the history of the city and our ability to address questions of equity and race. I'm sorry if that was too convoluted.
So the question is, how do we avoid sounding or being afraid of sounding political when we use certain language, Joshua?
Wow, shoot. I'm now listening to myself. That was not... I guess the importance of words to be able to address things and how our public officials are trying to eliminate some public words and how that will affect our ability, your ability as authors, to speak about those things.
Interesting. Anyone?
I just think if we use art to express what we need to say, I think that it will be received easier. I think that, you know, it's about semantics. You can use other words to still express, you know, what you're trying to say. But I also think we shouldn't be afraid to say the word that we want to say and say it with passion. I think that empathy is the answer to everything. And if I can find a way to emotionally and passionately express myself through my poetry, I think that I can get people to hear it differently. I have had, I think in one of the Zooms with St. Columba's, someone said something to that effect, that reading my memoir and reading the poetry, the way it was presented made them understand. So I think that being authentic and using your emotion words, your feeling words, you're gonna touch another human being, and they're gonna see beyond what they deem as political when you can connect with them on that level. I hope that answered your question.
Good advice, Janice. Stuart, you're a word guy. Do you have anything to add to this?
No, I mean, it is. I worked on the Hill for a long time, still work in political world, and I mean, it is astounding how good this administration is in carrying out, you know, from whatever it was, day one or day two of the first administration on alternative facts, and, you know, being able to convey that. You know, I think that's a great notion on the authenticity. And, you know, from, I don't know about actually writing something, and I'm going to say something that I think is really controversial here, I'm sure, but maybe I can go back to the Catholics after this, is that, you know, there's a slight, when we're taking down monuments, there's a slight concern I have. You know, I have a sort of theory, and I'm crazy, is that we almost ought to leave them up and post a similar-sized plaque that gives all of the cultural understanding of how this came about. You know, for Foote or the South, you know, we've got state flags, and I was looking at Alan, with Georgia and other places that basically in the 50s codified the Confederate battle flag and just existed, you know, on tops of state buildings without any sort of explanation about how that came about. And, you know, I think, I don't know what the answer is, but just understanding sort of, I think it's really important when we're creating, say, alternative facts, you know, speaking of that, that there has to be some sort of side-by-side awareness for all of us never to accept that as somehow a philosophical, an agreed upon universally, a universal consensus about that. So, you know, I just think it's really important to understand those sort of factors and constantly blow those up, or maybe in writing, whether it's fiction or what, I've been working on something. And I think it's real about a racial issue. And I think it's really important to dramatize those things just to sort of explode those cultural underpinnings that often lead our racist perspectives.
Rather than just doing Civil War reenactments over and over again. Right, right. Yes, go ahead.
I fell out here, I'm sorry. I want this discussion and discussions that have been going on for a long time brought to mind something from my college a long, many years ago, anthropology course by a great cultural anthropologist, Sidney Mintz.
You're also a Southerner, am I right?
I am. I grew up in Atlanta.
Yes.
And my family was from Kentucky, and I like John Prine's, my grandfather, like John Prine, the musician's grandfather, voted for Eisenhower because Lincoln won the war. They were Civil War Republicans in a border state, and they were anti-slavery. And then we moved to Atlanta when I was young, and we saw segregation, and it was astonishing. We couldn't believe it. That water fountains, my doctor's office, great doctor, they were white and colored. And my father, who was a Southern Baptist minister, defied law by sitting on the wrong side, wrong part of the bus. Every place he went, he would sit on the wrong side. So that's sort of my background, and I was active in our, just a little bit down that road. My father became a denominational leader in the Southern Baptist Convention, and we found out in our church, our local church, and the theory back then was you joined the closest church because that was kind of your response. You didn't choose, you just were part of the community. And we discovered that there was a racial exclusion clause in the church constitution that we didn't realize. And so we moved to change that. Yeah. And the congregation there, the chairman of the Board of Deacons was a big racist. And while my dad was out of town, they moved to disfellowship, which is the Baptist term for excommunicate him from the church, because he had invited Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College, to attend worship service with us after we had changed the rules to be racially inclusive.
So it's hard then to change. It's hard to impose change on others. I do see some people coming in, I think, expecting the 11:15 service. As much as we've enjoyed this, and thank you for your questions and comments, And thank you especially to our wonderful authors.